Hey everyone, Richard Nelson here with the Commonwealth Matters. Thank you so much for joining us. On today's program, we are going to talk about the big, beautiful bill that Congress passed and that the president signed on July 4th. And to be quite frank, I have been reluctant to talk about this. But now that the dust has settled and considering the major policy implications and the politics and the political fallout, I'd be remiss to not discuss it. Now, in the interest of not having you tune out, I have really attempted to cover the high points, the most significant things that I think it's important for all of us to know, and then to delve into the politics of it. There's some real political controversy here in the Commonwealth of Kentucky regarding this bill, as two of our congressmen voted against it. Thomas Massey, a House member from Northern Kentucky, was a no vote, and so was U.S. Senator Rand Paul. And we will discuss the politics and their rationale for voting against this bill as well. So the big, beautiful bill. I think we can agree across the spectrum, doesn't matter if you're Republican or Democrat, that it's big. In fact, it's an 800-page bill. So that's something that's objectively true, right? But as far as the beautiful part, well, they say beauty is in the eye of the beholder. So even in conservative circles, there is robust debate as to whether or not this was the best thing that a Republican majority, Republicans again hold both houses of Congress, the U.S. Senate and the U.S. House of Representatives, albeit those margins are very, very slim. And there is quite a diversity of opinion in both caucuses in the House and Senate. However, let's go over the main points of what the bill tried to accomplish. I think it's fair to say that the main goal, or maybe most significant thing that this bill does, is that it makes most of the 2017 tax cuts permanent. Now, Donald Trump made it one of his campaign promises back in 2016 that he would reform the tax code, bring it up to date, and to enact tax cuts, which were significant for the business community. And then for average Americans. So those tax cuts were made permanent with this big, beautiful bill. It increases spending for border security. That was a significant portion of it. It's close to $50 billion, I think $46 billion is going to be spent on new border security, including new portions of a wall going up. There's significant spending on national defense, and then also energy policy. Really, quite a difference between the Trump administration and the Biden administration as far as incentivizing the energy production here in this country, particularly with fossil fuels, as opposed to under the Biden administration, renewables were incentivized, whether it was solar or wind, tax deductions for electric vehicles, EVs. Now, here's where the critics come in, and I'm talking about conservative critics in particular. They've argued that it does not make enough permanent tax cuts to federal spending, and that deficit spending in the years to come is going to increase dramatically. And then there weren't enough permanent cuts to the federal program. So let's dig into some of the specific high points. And then I want to go into some of the statements that the critics have been making. So regarding taxes, I already mentioned that the 2017 tax cuts were made permanent. And according to the Treasury Department, they calculated that the average family of four will save roughly $2,000 a year. And that was under the 2017 tax cuts. And what this bill does is it makes those tax cuts permanent. They were set to expire at the end of this year. So if that bill didn't pass, another way of looking at this would be that there would have been a $2,000 tax increase on the average family of four. Several other important provisions, at least provisions that are receiving a lot of press, no tax on tips. Again, this is a popular idea. In fact, it's not just Republicans that are in favor of it, but Democrats have favored this as well. I think it's kind of a populist approach that people think of the waiters and waitresses as being hardworking people. Well, don't tax their tips. So that's what this bill does in part. There will be no tax on tips. There will be no tax on overtime. And this was a part that the idea was to incentivize work and to incentivize those who are, as I like to say, getting after it. This bill takes away the tax on overtime. Interestingly, there was taxes were reduced or taken away on car loan interest. I don't know the dynamics. We can speculate there, but found that to be an interesting provision regarding tax policy. Social conservatives were particularly happy with funding cuts to Planned Parenthood. This is something that pro-lifers in particular have asked for years. They've said, look, Planned Parenthood is the nation's largest abortion provider. They shouldn't be getting any tax dollars, even if it's not used for abortion. The proposal was to defund them. There was a compromise made, and the funding will be cut to Planned Parenthood for 1 year. And this means grants and contracts. The previous arrangement that the government had with Planned Parenthood, that's put on pause for a whole year. As a result, Planned Parenthood facilities across the country are shutting down. And I've seen in several quarters where pro-lifers are rejoicing. Now, of course, critics are saying, well, look, Planned Parenthood provides things like cancer screening and other services, particularly to the poor. And they act like Planned Parenthood is the only outlet that is doing these things. Not true. There are other clinics. There are free clinics. There are local clinics, other outlets that are providing the same things without getting involved with abortions, without getting involved with promoting gender ideology to minors and the controversial activity that they're involved with. Another thing the bill does is they cut funding for the Corporation of Public Broadcasting. This means PBS and NPR are no longer going to get federal funding. Now, it was a small portion to begin with. I think 15% of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, or actually, take that back, of NPR funding, 15% came from the federal government. But the funding will be cut. The argument goes like this, that first of all, they're left-leaning, which has infuriated conservatives. When political issues come up or public policy issues come up, conservatives have complained that this is a publicly funded institution, media outlets, and for them to report against conservative policies and principles isn't fair. The other thing at work here, too, is that we have a media ecology today that is diverse. Many, many more news outlets, radio stations, TV stations, podcasts that are available. And they're all doing it on their own. They're not receiving state or federal funding. Therefore, a Corporation for Public Broadcasting should be able to do it on their own too. And that's precisely what's happening. By the way, in Kentucky, KET, Kentucky Education Television, which I think provides some good resources to Kentuckians, resources as far as what's going on in the General Assembly. They show up at the annual Fancy Farm event and they carry live coverage there. They said, we're not going to do it. We won't be at Fancy Farm. And lo and behold, within a couple weeks, an anonymous donor stepped forward and said, hey, we're going to make a donation to cover any potential funding loss. We want you to do the Fancy Farm event, and KET will be there. So it's not like an entity like the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, or KET for that matter, will go away. It's just a matter of who will fund them. And I'm pretty confident that many of the public radio and TV outlets will still be in business. Their funding source is just going to be different. Hi, Richard Nelson here with the Commonwealth Policy Center. Have you found yourself frustrated and angry about the direction of the country? Maybe you're watching Fox News and you see what's happening in Congress or in other parts of the country. Let me encourage you to turn your frustration and energy into a positive direction. Have you considered running for local office? And listen to me for a minute. You can have a greater impact on local elections and on policy decisions if you serve in local government. School board, for example, they set curriculum decisions and tax policy. How about city council or fiscal court? These are very important elected offices where you can have a positive impact on. Consider running for local office. CPC is bringing candidate training events all across the state, and we'd love for you to join. If you've ever felt called to run or interested in running, come on and join us. You can find out more information at the Commonwealth Policy website at commonwealthpolicycenter.org. Go ahead and check it out, and we hope to see you in the fall. An interesting tax provision, by the way, goes to thoroughbred farms. And I'm just wondering how much influence Mitch McConnell and other Kentucky congressmen had with this. But in this big, beautiful bill, it says that thoroughbred owners and breeders can now deduct the cost of assets like their racing prospects, their equipment, land improvements, barns, big tax write-offs for horse farm owners. And this particularly benefits Kentucky. I've got personal thoughts on that. I know that those in the horse industry are very, very glad for that. Anytime the government is taking less of your resources, you're able to spend it elsewhere. And I think that is a conservative principle that we can just pause for a moment and say, you know, one thing behind this so-called big, beautiful bill is whether or not the government can do better with your resources and with my resources, or is it individuals and businesses? Are they the ones that should be making decisions for what they do with their wealth and their resources? All right, moving on to a few tax credits. There was an increase in the child tax credit to $2,200 per child. That was previously at $2,000. So $2,200 is going to be helpful to those parents with children. There's an enhancement to the adoption credit and also an enhancement of the dependent care assistance program. According to the White House, here's their assessment, and the thinking behind this is going back to what I just said a moment ago. It's a question of who does better with wealth and with resources. Is it the government, and in this case, the federal government, or is it individuals? And then what's the impact of that? When individuals have more money in their pocket, what does that look like as opposed to a great big federal budget? And by the way, we're looking at $2, $3 trillion for an annual budget. A lot of money that's being spent by the federal government. So according to the White House, this bill is going to put more than $10,000 a year back into the pockets of typical hardworking families. And they call this the most pro-growth, pro-worker, pro-family legislation ever crafted. So the goal here is to put more money back into the pockets of hardworking people. They make the decision of where it's spent. The other thing that happens too is that when more people have more money to spend, it circulates in their local economy, and the thinking is that it's going to rev up the economy. Now, we'll see. There are different projections here. On the political left, they're saying, look, the deficit spending and the reduced federal budget is going to hurt. Those supply-siders are saying, hey, give more money to the people. Let them keep more of their hard-earned dollars and let them invest it. Let them spend it. And we'll see what happens. I think within the next couple of years, we will see the practical impact that this bill will have on local economies, state economies, and at the national level as well. Now, one of the most controversial portions of this bill is that it rolls back federal benefits, particularly with SNAP, formerly known as food stamps, and Medicaid. So the big, beautiful bill requires work or school or volunteer efforts for those who are able-bodied and in between in working ages. I think it's 18 to 60, maybe 59, somewhere in there. But it's saying, look, if you receive federal funding, if you're getting food stamps, you should work at least part-time. And that's what it requires. So as this is, only 28% of able-bodied adults within the working age parameters, 18 to 60 roughly, only 28% are working. And we're not talking about moms with kids, by the way. We're talking about single adults, individuals who are capable of working, but they just chose not to. So the White House says this, that this bill promotes work, responsibility, and it restores SNAP to serve the truly needy. And the same is true for Medicaid. And I'm going to dig into that in just a little bit. And I want to dig into it by going into some of the criticisms that were leveled at it. Several Kentucky legislators, by the way, chimed in and voiced their opposition. They believe that they were misrepresented and that this bill was misrepresented also. Hey, one significant thing, I'd be remiss if I didn't discuss this. It's an overlooked provision in this bill regards school choice. Now, there was an effort in the original proposal to create an EOA at the federal level. An EOA is an education opportunity account. It's where individuals and businesses make contributions to a grant-making body, to this EOA. And then each state would have a grant-making authority, a board that would give scholarships to low-income, needy families. Originally, it had, I want to say it was $50 billion proposed for this EOA. It wasn't going to cost taxpayers anything because it was a tax write-off, but the benefit would particularly trickle down to, again, states that did not have EOAs and states that did not have school choice, like Kentucky. We are one of two states that really does not have any school choice provision in our law. So this bill, the tax credit was reduced. Again, it was capped at in the millions of dollars. They did come down to a compromise, and they allowed EOAs to exist, to come into existence. But the donation to them, instead of, I think it would, I want to say it was like $25 million, it's down to $1,700 a year per person. So if there are generous people, let's say in Kentucky, that wanted to donate to a fund in EOA, Educational Opportunity Account here, they could donate $1,700 a year. There would be a tax write-off if you fall into that tax bracket where you can claim deductions. So we'll see what happens with this. It's a modest beginning, nowhere near the original proposal that it was, but it is a step towards school choice. And in principle, by the way, we as Americans like to talk about choices. We like to go to different supermarkets, and within those supermarkets, we choose different kind of foods. We choose the kind of car we drive. We can choose the work we pursue. But it's funny, when it comes to education, which is, I would say, much more important than having an abundance of material choices, although I'm grateful for those things. I'm grateful that we have all kinds of choices and that we're blessed with a lot of food choices and cars and kind of home and neighborhood we live in. But education is a really important thing. And there's a part of our society that doesn't think that parents should have a choice, or at least a tax credit or charter school or other kind of choice mechanism so that they can provide what they believe is the best education for their child. Now, I think that's probably another program, but in principle, the point here is that we as Americans love choices. We love opportunity, that idea of opportunity. When it comes to education, that's something where there's a significant and influential part of our society that is opposed to that. We probably need to do another program on that. All right, let's get back to the big, beautiful bill. I mentioned at the outset that there's a number of provisions that address energy policy. So there's termination of the clean vehicle credit. So EVs, if you buy an electric vehicle, there were tax credits for that, new or used, by the way. Those are going to be done away with. And then also subsidies generally for the renewable energy industry. Those are going to be done away with. On the other side, there is reducing regulations when it comes to drilling for oil or mining for coal. Coal-fired plants are encouraged. The goal here is energy independence, which is significant. We have, for the last several decades, 50 years or so, really depended on foreign oil. And the goal here is for us to open up drilling, whether it's in Alaska or offshore. We've got a lot of oil here and a lot of other fossil fuel resources, coal, natural gas, that could be used if burdensome regulations were removed and if encouragement for exploring was put into place. And that's what this bill does. So here's the criticism. Let's go into the politics. The criticism, and I'm going to start with Kentucky Center for Economic Policy Director Jason Bailey. This is what he said in a social media post. He called the bill's passage a, quote, shameful moment. The bill will take healthcare coverage and food assistance from hundreds of thousands of Kentuckians, the biggest such cuts in history. He goes on to say that it will increase hardship, worsen health, and weaken our economy. And it does so to pay for just a portion of tax cuts that go overwhelmingly to the wealthy and the powerful. Now, here's the question. Is this true? Now, depending on your worldview and your idea of government, some of you may say, yeah, this is terrible. What's happening? There's cuts to SNAP and there's cuts to Medicaid. If you dig in a little deeper, you'll find that there really weren't cuts. There are new requirements in order to receive these federal benefits. Listen to what Kentucky Congressman Brett Guthrie, he is in the Bowling Green area, represents the 2nd Congressional District. This is what Brett Guthrie said. He wrote a column defending what they did to update Medicaid and to make it more fiscally responsible and to make it serve the people it was intended to serve when it was first created. Brett Guthrie said this in a column. There are 4.8 million able-bodied adults currently on Medicaid who choose not to work. A survey showed this population spending roughly 184 hours a month watching television and socializing. That's 50% higher than employed beneficiaries. So friends, here's the question, and I think what Brett Guthrie's getting at. If you are able-bodied, if you are not the primary caregiver of children or caring for a dependent, why shouldn't you work in order to receive this federal benefit? And the work requirement is 20 hours a week? That's the question. And they're trying to, by the way, work is a good thing. Work is dignifying. You have better health outcomes if you are working. So there's a number of positives from this. But friends, this is hardly taking healthcare from people who need it and then kicking them out into the street and saying, hey, if you're going to participate in this federal program, here's some requirements. And by the way, these requirements are good for you. They bring dignity. You're going to be healthier if you work, which I think this is what Republicans, and look, that shouldn't be a Republican or Democrat talking point. That should be something I think that we see across the spectrum, that we want people to embrace dignity and to live dignifying lives. We want people to be healthier. The question is, how do we get there? According to the White House, they commented on the Medicaid upgrade, Medicaid policy changes. They say that the 20-hour weekly work requirement applies only to able-bodied adults, just like I said, without young children, and it promotes dignity, stability, and better health outcomes for families. It restores the dignity of work with historically bipartisan work requirements. Interestingly enough, the White House points back to the Clinton era where they required work requirements too, volunteer education or training or work in order to receive federal benefits. Andy Beshear said this, Americans were betrayed with the passage of the big ugly bill. Jobs will be lost. Hospitals will close. Rural communities will suffer. Living costs will go up. And worst of all, people will die from being thrown off their health coverage. He said that the bill puts politics over people and our country deserves better. Again, the question, friends, is this true? You'd think that the sky is falling, that Republicans are evil, and that people are going to die because of it. We will find out as far as how this impacts people. And by the way, what the governor's saying there is, I strongly disagree with that and his assessment. And when I say we'll find out, I'm gonna modify that. We're gonna find out that what he's saying isn't going to come to pass and is not true. Okay, so here's where some of the controversy comes in, and I need to wind this down. We're running out of time. The downside is that this bill raises the debt ceiling by $5 trillion. This is like increasing our national credit card limit. This bill fails to make permanent DOGE cuts, Department of Government Efficiency cuts. The Congressional Budget Office estimated that the version of the bill passed by the House will add $2.7 trillion to the deficit over the next 10 years. Now, there was a compromise between the House and Senate. It is still going to add trillions. I think it's still close to $3 trillion to the deficit over the next 10 years. With that said, that is my analysis, touching the high points on the big, beautiful bill. And I want to thank you all for joining us. Please tune in next time for another edition of The Commonwealth Matters. Thank you, and may God bless you.